This is the Joy of Gaming. Welcome to a very special edition of the Joy of Gaming podcast. I'm your host, Rich Lepore, and I'm here with...
Jordan Alseca.
And Tim McNeil.
And today we actually have a very special guest, Nick Taylor. Actually, I'm going to let you tell listeners about yourself, because I don't think I could remember it if I tried.
My name is Nick Taylor. I'm a five-month-old assistant professor of digital media in the Department of Communication at North Carolina State University, hailing from Toronto, Canada, which is the reason for my outrageous accent.
Funny, I could barely detect it, Nick.
I didn't really notice it until you said it either.
Thanks, eh?
Oh, okay. Okay, now he's going to emphasize it. All right, that's cool. How did you like the South Park movie, Nick?
Did you see that?
It's one of my favorites.
I figured. Okay. Well, today we're going to be talking about a wide variety of subjects, especially Major League Gaming and professional esports in general and sort of the evolution of that. Nick has done a lot of research on that subject, and so we'll be discussing that. As well as sort of the issue of gender in gaming. Also some discussion of MMOs and people's personas offline and online. And other interesting, intellectual
just a few
gaming
others.
Conversation.
Yeah, a few other small topics. We're kind of going by, what you spend the most time researching, Nick. So it should be good.
Cool.
So I think the best way to start is how we always start, except focus on you, Nick, and tell us what you've been playing lately.
Okay, so now I'm going to have to out myself for real. Let me just situate this by saying that I was a huge Guild Wars 1 fan, so I'm kind of doing a legacy addiction to Guild Wars 2.
there was a long hiatus between the two, wasn't there?
Not for me, there wasn't.
Okay, right. All right.
Just kind of rolled over into the new one. And I just put together my first ever DIY gaming rig, and so I'm making it hum, playing some high-level Guild Wars 2, and I'm enjoying it, like, immensely.
What did you use to benchmark your system when you got it all built? Did you do the whole Crysis 1 test or whatever?
I used a grad student.
That's requisite if you're going to be a professor, right?
Yeah, ask my grad student.
All right. What else? What before that?
Let's see. I've played the heck out of Skyrim. Put about 100 hours into that one.
Isn't that ridiculous?
That's like the average.
Probably only got about half of it, too.
No. I'm not saying that his usage is ridiculous. I'm saying that what a ridiculous game to have that much content is so crazy. It's daunting to me.
It got the day before yesterday.
Yeah, I know.
Because it got the Dragonborn DLC.
I know. And any other DLC is probably like, 5 hours or 3 hours max. This one's probably like 40.
Yeah, no, totally. So I like to think of myself as kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to games and dabbling different games, but I'm really not. I think I have to fess up. I am an RPG freak. but that said, I do have to play some different games for research and for my teaching, which is a horrible burden. So I've also been messing around with Super Meat Boy, a great Xbox arcade title called Mark of the Ninja, which is fabulous.
I've heard about that. What is that sort of like side-scroller?
It's a 2D stealth platformer, I guess you'd call it. Very stylized art. Very interesting and I would say kind of very innovative use of light and sound to set up what really shouldn't be such an addictive and immensely rewarding stealth experience, but is one of the best stealth games I can imagine in recent memory.
How do they pull that off, doing stealth in a 2D perspective?
It's all about the play of light and shadow and about the visual representation of noises. So you can kind of crouch beside a door and you don't know what's on the other side of the door, but you can see a visual representation of footsteps, the sound of footsteps. So it plays with representations of sound, with it plays obviously with verticality a lot. You can use all sorts of pipes, tunnels, floorboards to your advantage, and it's wicked fun. Highly recommended.
Cool. Yeah, it definitely does. In fact, you're the first person I've really heard talk about that at length, and now I definitely want to check it out.
Yeah. It just kind of popped up on the dashboard. I saw it, but I didn't download the demo.
A month or two ago, right? Yeah.
And it's wickedly gory. You know, it's got some great finishers.
Oh, I love
it. You know, how can you go wrong with multiple ways of slicing a guy's throat?
That's actually really cool. I have to apologize to the listeners. I'm just getting over a cold here, so my voice sounds really deep. You might not even recognize me, but
I think it sounds anyway. Better.
Oh, okay.
More distinguished.
There you go.
Try not to read anything into that.
You got a Barry White tune. Do it now.
I had this really funny neighbor back in the day, and he would put on Barry White records. He's a total white dude, like 45-year-old guy. And he'd put on Barry White records, and every time we come over, he'd be like, "Yo, man, you bring the Newports and all kinds of stuff." The guy was hilarious. And then he had this cute little Scottish Terrier. It was like really white little dog. And he was like, "Man, Scotty, you too white to be right." It was so funny, man. This guy was hilarious.
You know, maybe you'd look at that guy as maybe Barry White was his second life, right?
You know?
Maybe Barry White was his virtuality.
It's some Cloud Atlas shit.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
No doubt. So do you get into any of like the big name like AAA franchises like Assassin's Creed or Halo or any of those?
You know, studying games is a lot like what happens when you take English class and you take a really good book that you love and then you study it and then you end up hating it.
Much like game testing it would probably do as well.
Yeah. Yeah, but much less rigorous than game testing. So yeah, I really enjoyed Assassin's Creed right up until I think right up until number two.
Oh, okay.
No, Assassin's Creed for me is a really interesting case of kind of overindulgence in terms of design. You take an amazing, amazing mechanic, and you take this game where you have like just the beauty and the joy and the pleasure of moving through a three-dimensional world that is perfectly designed for your character's capabilities. And then you add this bizarre kind of sci-fi element on top of it.
Huh.
And really, for me, that's a paradigmatic case of story getting in the way of gameplay. I don't know. I just, and then they added the Native American stuff on top of it for number three, and I just thought this feels a little bit too much like Glenn Beck's Wet Dream. I don't know.
that's interesting. I never really heard it that way. See, for me, when I first saw the original Assassin's Creed announced, and I was looking at all the teaser stuff, it was Jade Raymond from Ubisoft who was like, you know, the person that was, you know, like the creative director when it first was announced.
She's a star, yeah.
She's awesome. She sort of disappeared into obscurity somewhere in Canada recently.
She's heading up the Toronto Ubisoft studio, so really? Your obscurity is my holy cow. This
right.
is really happening.
maybe so, but you know what? Like for a while, like she popped back up on she blipped back up on like the big websites with I Am Alive, and then she dropped off that project. I actually worked at Ubisoft for a little while.
Right.
So I sort of heard all about this and like, you know, how she made a decision at a certain point to go low pro.
Yeah.
Which
right.
is interesting because she was sort of like the hottest game developer chick, everyone used to say.
Absolutely.
And stuff. So, I mean, I guess, I don't know how, you know, a very serious girl like her would feel about that. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question.
But anyway, the point I was trying to say was that when that game was announced, it was like you'd see the previews and like there would be these weird zeros and ones and flickers in the background and Jade would be like, "We're not talking about that aspect yet, but this meta thing that's going on in the game." And at that point, I was really intrigued by it. So I don't know, but I don't know if you, I'm sure you know this, but like this supposedly Assassin's Creed 3 is the end of that character, that modern day Desmond's character's story.
Okay.
So I wonder what they'll do now. You know.
Geez, I don't know. Hopefully they'll scale it back. I mean, it just seems to go a little too Dan Brown for me, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I kind of wish they took out the entire modern day stuff with it. My favorite things with the Assassin's Creed series was just being able to, you know, like climb around in the Colosseum and stuff like that. That
Absolutely.
Was the coolest stuff to me.
Absolutely.
And the modern day stuff, it's like, I don't really care about Desmond. I don't care about the world ending.
It's so brief, and across five games, it gets hard to care after that point.
And they're really trying to push it. Like, they want you to care, but it's just like, I really don't.
Yeah, they bookend the games. Beginning and end are always, you know, that and so it's like that's supposed to be, and I think it was probably originally they thought incorrectly, I would say, that gamers wouldn't be able to like get down with it if it's too like old.
Yeah.
Like, if it takes place too far in the past, they wouldn't be able to relate or whatever.
This is history, yeah.
I thought that would be a lot more interesting, though, is just take one of the time periods and set a game in that period and just keep it there the whole time with it.
Yeah.
I always thought that would be cooler.
I mean, I totally agree with that. I also think the possibility of doing a franchise built around assassins or, you know, the assassin concept in different epochs in history has a lot of promise.
Yeah.
I think that's what got me really excited about it. I just think what where they kind of went wrong is through this notion that, you know, you had to bring it up to the present day through what it feels like a walking cutscene. And, you know, I saw, this is kind of diverging a bit, but I think it was a Kotaku video, a shot from the most recent one where Desmond and the British guy are talking, and the British guy gives a really interesting kind of revisionist history reading, very sympathetic to the British, mm-hmm. of the American Revolution. And I thought, gosh, it's so great, but why can't you let us play through that instead of just listening to, you know, some English fop character tell us, you know? It just seems very kind of didactic as opposed to interactive, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, because having played through it, they try to show it, but then the fact that they're always kind of telling you there's
it is lines. Always through the cutscenes with it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I think the storyline is pretty even keeled throughout it. Like, for a while, it seems like it's very, you know, pro-America, anti-British. But then by the end of it, it gets a little more even keel with it. But, like, I really wish there was more gameplay with the good stuff with it, though. It's a good story, though.
Yeah. One of the, if I can make a little plug for research.
Sure.
Yeah. One of the most interesting articles, so when I was up in Canada at York University, I was involved with, and I still am involved with, the Canadian Game Studies Association, which puts out a journal called Loading every quarter. So one of the best articles on Loading was this team. It was an interdisciplinary and multi-ethnicity team of scholars. A couple of them were Muslim, and a couple of them were plain old Caucasian. And they did a kind of multicultural, multi-perspectival reading of the first Assassin's Creed, which really tried to do that thing where it, you know, give us a balanced view of a kind of politically fraught conflict. And they said, you know, it did a really interesting job of retelling history from the perspective of both sides. And as, you know, as Muslims, the players felt really kind of vindicated in taking a Western game and kind of doing a non-Western perspective. And so I think the game, the franchise had the opportunity to do that. And then it kind of fell off what I guess you call like the Dan Brown cliff into kind of, you know, in the next game you're fighting the Pope, but he's also, you know, a Templar, but he's also a whatever. It just feels like it kind of lost a little bit of that resonance. And that.
It's Da Vinci Code all over the place.
Yeah.
And where's the Apple of Eden? And yeah.
Yeah.
The third one's a little better with that because there's still the Templar assassin fights, but a lot of the main historical figures aren't members of the Order.
Right.
And so it's sort of just like you see the war going on in that time frame. So it's just like this is happening and they're around it, but they're not the people doing it.
Right.
I thought, too, that was sort of a thing with the tour. It's like, oh, it's kind of cool that these people are assassins and Templars, but is every single historical figure really an assassin or a Templar?
Whole Borgia family.
Yeah, the whole and Borgia,
like,
family.
Machiavelli, really? Do we really have to do that violence to, you know, one of the great Italian thinkers of the whatever century it was, 15th? Yeah. I show my complete historical ignorance there.
But any other big franchises you have strong feelings on either way? How about BioShock? It's my favorite game pretty much ever.
Oh, gosh. I am completely agnostic on BioShock. I've never even picked it up, if you can believe it. Yeah.
See, that's a shortcoming, my friend. You need to hit that.
I should do it for research purposes, obviously.
Yeah, skip the second one, because it's not like, you know, I'm sure a big thing for me in video games is like auteur theory or these auteur people.
Right.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing that word correctly, but, you know, people like the David Jaffes and in the case of BioShock, Ken Levine.
Yep.
The guy who did Rayman, what's his name?
Can't think of it. Ansel,
something. Michel Ansel, mm-hmm. people like that. These like Miyamoto,
right.
these virtuoso types.
Yeah.
And Ken Levine is fits soundly in that category for me. He was System Shock 2, and then
right.
and then BioShock. I mean, there's some I'm leaving out, but he did BioShock 1, and now he's coming back with like what I think is going to be maybe the best game of the last 5 years, is this BioShock Infinite. I mean, it looks amazing.
Right.
Have you seen anything on that?
No, I haven't. But I think what you bring up is really interesting, and is kind of I guess representative to me of how sophisticated gaming or gamers have become, when it becomes possible to follow an author through different franchises as opposed to just following a franchise. I was reminded of this powerfully when one of my close friends in Canada basically kind of rage quit Guild Wars 2 because he like me wanted to play it out of a sense of legacy of Guild Wars 1 and a love of this world and a love of the franchise. But he said, you know, Jeff Strain quit that game very, you know, at a key point in its development. Jeff Strain was one of, you know, the creative talents behind the initial Guild Wars 1, one of the guys, one of the visionaries that made that game so interesting and innovative. And so when Jeff Strain quit Guild Wars 2 and went off to do other work, you know, this friend of mine kind of kind of had a shudder run through his entire being and thought, oh my gosh, this is not good. And so he's recently cued onto what I think you just kind of talked about really, really nicely, which is, you know, the ability now to follow game creators through their career and kind of base your sense of what's canonical or what you need to play based on not what a studio has put out or not what, you know, what not what's available on a certain platform, but what's put out by key figures that are actually making games.
It's like in any medium, though, you know, it's you need the creative talent is everything.
But I think, I mean, exactly, you said it right. It's like any other medium, but I think games have finally reached that point where that's a legitimate perspective to take.
You think it's a recent thing or do you think it's been around?
I think it's been around in circles. Mm-hmm. I think it's becoming more mainstream.
Okay.
You know? I mean, what's really interesting is that, you know, it's completely different by culture, too. I went to the Tokyo Game Show in 2007.
Oh, wow. That must have been awesome.
It was the best. That was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
I'm extremely jealous.
And there, you know, it's like you had these amazing presentations. You couldn't understand a word of it because the translations were, you know, the on-site translations were so bad. But by Japanese soundtrack makers for different games. Like, I think at one point there was a talk by the Japanese sound guy behind the Final Fantasy series.
Uematsu?
Yeah.
And it's like a rock star ascended the stage. Like, it really, like, it brought the house down because people were just awed by the presence of this guy.
So, Tim, tell the MAGFest.
Yeah, I always plug MAGFest. I do panels for a video game convention called MAGFest, the Music Gaming Festival. We had Uematsu come last year with it, but we're big about, like, lots of, like, kind of obscure musicians from the past, but people have really big followings around them and, like, within the musical community.
And there was a line around the entire, like, the whole Gaylord Hotel was packed with a line to meet this guy, like he was Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
to
about 2,500 people in that line, probably.
I mean, I think it's just, that's a sign of us kind of all maturing as a culture, right? The point where we can kind of start really getting a passion for individual creators.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it is the thing that is getting more recognition with the bigger names that, you know, you see with Ken Levine. But I've been a fan of the behemoth who made Alien Hominid back in, like, 2003, and I followed him to Castle Crashers, and I'm still waiting for Battle Block Theater to come out. But it is the sort of thing.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Anytime they have, because they've done a bunch of Flash games on Newgrounds that you can play all the time. And even though that's online and it's free, it's a pair of creators that I follow pretty regularly because their work is so unique in style and whatnot.
I do always find it interesting when you can tell, like, the head creator's left a series and you're just like, it doesn't feel the
same.
And, like, totally. You may not be able to pinpoint it exactly, but it's like, there's something different about it that I don't know exactly what it is.
Well, and I think we're at a point where we're developing a language and a grammar for being able to articulate that, right? I mean, what it is about Guild Wars 2 that is not like Guild Wars 1 and why you kind of miss, you know, for instance, that creative voice in Guild Wars 2 as you grind your way through the 800th daily achievement quest.
I used to be really, really big into the Sukoden RPG series, and I loved Sukoden 1 and 2. And then in 3 was okay, but the main designer left halfway through.
Right.
And you could tell that he left halfway through because the second half, it had all the content of, like, oh, this would have been really cool, but it was went really, really quickly. Right. Well, the first part was much more drawn out. And then the fourth was just an abysmal game.
Right.
And then the fifth, it was good, but it just wasn't the same. And then the series kind of died afterwards.
one of the studios I'm falling in love with is Amanita Designs. They did, what was the name? Machinarium. And then
PC house,
adventure
right?
game type.
They're like a PC development house.
Yeah, yeah, based in Czechoslovakia, I think. They did Machinarium, and then recently put out Botanicula.
Yeah.
And what I love about those games, and talk about a contrast to something like AAA titles with the kind of bonky over the head storyline like Assassin's Creed, is that there's virtually no verbal communication or written text. Which I come from an educational background. One of the reasons why I started studying games is because I think they're really powerful or can be powerful learning tools if we get over the fact that what they best communicate is text, right?
Yeah.
One of the things I love about the Amanita guys is that they really embrace this notion that you don't need verbalization or text.
Have you played Flower or Journey?
Story. Yeah.
Yeah, I love those games. They're my favorite games ever.
Yeah.
Like, I'm from an education background as well. And just like, I love the ability to communicate and for people to understand completely visually. And that's just amazing for me.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I put Shadow of the Colossus in that same category.
Yeah. That game is so atmospheric and beautiful.
And
it's got a mood. It can depress you, it can uplift you. It's really impressive.
What I always love about it is just like, Shadow of the Colossus, one of the things I love about it, is how they use just the empty space to make you be reflective.
Yeah.
And so you're in this dark, dreary world, and you're doing something you're not quite exactly sure where. And so you got nothing else to do when you're just going across a desert other than to just think about what you're doing. And then that's when you start to realize, like, why am I doing this? I feel really bad now for killing this stuff. But that's such a like homogenous experience across everyone who plays that game. There's not people like, oh, I never thought that. Like, everybody thinks that.
Yeah,
and it's never said.
Yeah. So it communicates a kind of a moral ambivalence without kind of telling you, I'm communicating a moral ambivalence. You know what I mean?
And rhetorically, that's so much more effective, especially from an educational background, because it's like, when a person comes to a conclusion on their own, they're going to remember it, and they're going to understand it more than when someone tells someone sort of something with that.
Yeah.
That's why I always think Flower, it's like, at the end of that game, I was like, man, maybe I should turn off my stuff and go out into the woods. And I was like, damn, this is good propaganda.
Well, you know, the oldest lesson in writing, you know, writing teachers say show, don't tell.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and it's like about time that games, you know, jumped on the bandwagon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally agree. Totally agree.
I think that's interesting. I think now would be a good time for us to sort of hear more about your background, how you got to where you are now, and what you're working on now.
So I started, I'm a humanist through and through, but I've kind of become a social scientist over the course of my master's, and then my PhD, and then my postdoc, and now in my research at NC State. I got into games because, or game studies, which is an actual field. There's a journal called Game Studies, there's another journal called Games and Culture, there's a whole kind of academic discipline called Game Studies right now, which is very, very fervent and lively. I got into it because really through the education angle, because I like many others think that you know, the education system fails a lot of people who aren't and were never good will never be very good at or particularly inclined towards textual communication or verbal communication. And so seeing games are really kind of a strong basis for experiential learning. So I got into games that way, and then really that just kind of took off into in my dissertation, which I defended in 2009. I did a study of the Canadian esports community, competitive gaming community. That moved from there into a three-year study for my postdoctoral research with a multidisciplinary team where we looked at online role-playing games and the connection between your online persona and your offline persona. And now I'm back at NC, or back on the esports bandwagon, I guess. Hoping to do a little more research here in the Raleigh area.
And you know, that was something that was interesting to me. I mean, we can sit here and talk about the types of non-textual communication and the sort of smaller development teams that and authorial vision. But one of the biggest games every year, regardless, is Call of Duty and shooters, and that culture that's developed through esports. And I mean, there are other types of game, but they're very much about competition as opposed to experiential.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what have you seen through that? Because it seems like even though there are gamers that really appreciate that sort of stuff, the biggest thing is still those types of esport, you know, darlings that kind of come out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what drives the industry in a lot of ways. I mean, I think, you know, if you don't have Call of Duty selling X million copies, then you know, analysts or, you know, financial analysts look at the industry and say, "Oh crap,
it's failing." Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think they drive kind of mainstream interest in games. I think they drive a lot of the technology that goes behind games. I think those are the blockbuster titles. In terms of esports, it's really interesting to me over the course of you know, having studied it in 2008 and 2009, and then kind of kept an eye on it, but not really gotten involved with any of the communities, and then coming back to it in 2012. It's amazing how much has changed, and it's kind of really threatening to become mainstream, I think.
Let me ask you a question about that, because one of the things I was always amazed at esports is how a game's longevity can be so long within it. Because, you know, a lot of games, you know, people stop playing it after a year, but you look at StarCraft, came out in 98. People were playing that until StarCraft 2 came out. People still play it. You look at Counter-Strike.
Yep.
You look at Marvel vs. Capcom 2. All these games play for like 10, 15 years after they come out.
World of Warcraft.
Yeah. But even though that's got updates with it, I mean, that's not, you know, like competitive games and sort of stuff with it.
Yeah.
Do you think that by having their yearly releases for these AAA titles, that sometimes detracts from their ability to be effective esports titles?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, in a lot of ways, the biggest enemy to the mainstream success of esports is the games industry, because the games industry is built on constant cyclical change.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas esports, you know, it really takes players years to develop.
Yeah.
And it takes a scene years to develop, right? I think you're completely right. I think you know, esports needs to be built on a kind of a sense of longevity and of engagement with a particular, not even a particular franchise, a particular game. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I was studying Major League Gaming and the kind of community that was created around Major League Gaming in 2008, 2009, right when it made the transition from Halo 2 to Halo 3. And that was intensely disruptive. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like in the NFL, changing the size of the football field and adding, you know, adding different balls or, you know, changing the number of players that could
different
be on the
rules.
Field. It literally changes the skill sets and therefore changes what's required of players to become top at that game. And yep. It's,
Rich and I, a few years ago, we went to the first MLG they had in Raleigh, and we interviewed one of the teams, mm-hmm. and this was right before Halo Reach came out, and they were talking about how much they still didn't like Halo 3 at that point,
yeah.
because it had really changed things. There were a lot of tricks from Halo 2 that just didn't work anymore. Guns were different. It really threw off their flow, and that to a certain extent, they were kind of looking forward to Reach just because it seemed to reinstate some of that stuff. But at the same time, they'd gotten used to the system over 3 years, and it was kind of...
yeah.
Three or two, I forget exactly, but it messed them up a little.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think there is a sense in which definitely, as you were saying, games have to have a kind of longevity behind them yeah. in order to be successful, and that and that is kind of antithetical in some cases to the MO of the games industry.
Yeah, because, I mean, they'll stop selling and people still want to play and sort of stuff with it. It's almost like they have to make money off the marketing of it if they were to keep it that way, but that's probably not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm gonna make a plug for a colleague of mine here, T.L. Taylor. She's at MIT, no relation, but a good colleague of mine put out a book called Raising the Stakes, which is, I think, really one of the first or the first historical academic book on esports. And she talks about those kinds of issues, the tensions between, you know, a community that needs games to hang around for a while and an industry that needs to keep on pumping out, you know, Call of Duty 18
yeah.
in order, or the perception is they need to do that in order to continue to be viable and relevant. So it's a really interesting tension. I mean, you'd think they'd be right in cahoots with each other, mm-hmm. but
it's interesting that you say that there are some developers now that you bring this up. I think of Valve
uh-huh.
and I think of Blizzard.
Yeah.
As two companies, you know, with examples of games that have been really popular in this way.
Yeah.
And they're games that, you know, pop culture and gamers, you know, I've been guilty of this myself. Like, where is Halo? I mean, excuse me, Half-Life 3. Where is it, damn it? You
yeah.
know? And where is the sequel to whatever?
Yeah.
And they just aren't pumping out sequels. They aren't pumping out games year to year. And maybe it has to do something with that synergy between them and their community. Because I know they do a lot of updates. They support their PC modding communities a lot, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, you know, World of Warcraft is a living, changing beast, right? I mean, and so is StarCraft too. I mean, I think they're balancing that game every 2 minutes, aren't they? I mean,
not so much with StarCraft. It's usually pretty bigger for one of
okay,
those other things.
Okay, that just shows you my ignorance of all things of all things StarCraft. Yeah, I mean, I where I thought we were going to go when you brought up Blizzard is its kind of contentious relationship to the esports community.
You mean with what they license, which ones they license, like for the,
I mean, the
global
basic
StarCraft League and
kinda
competition
yeah.
in Korea and all.
Exactly. Again, in this book, Raising the Stakes, my colleague T.L. Taylor makes the point that, or kind of uses as a case study of this relationship, the kind of fallout between Blizzard and the, I forget the name of it, the Korean Esports League.
Interesting.
Over who should pay whom to have World of Warcraft featured in, or sorry, StarCraft featured in games competitions.
Yeah.
Right? Does a company pay the organization because you're getting amazing press for your game? Or does the organization pay the company for using their licensed product?
You'd think it should be just like mutually beneficial.
Absolutely.
Perfect, yeah. You know, synergy.
Yeah, yeah. But
that never works in capitalism, you know?
No. Perfect synergy, no. I mean, and what's funny is that lost in that kind of debate or that kind of interaction between Blizzard and the Korean esports organization is the voice of the players, right? And that's, you know, typical, I think.
Well, one thing, like, we're talking about the games and the companies, and even though, the games need to say the same, one thing that when we talked before that was interesting is you said, as soon as, like, being in academia, it's very hard because as soon as you'll go to say something, things have kind of changed in the
yeah.
culture.
Yeah.
So what is it about the people that has been changing so much? Like, just even in the past 4 years, there have been a lot of changes. And what's driving that change in the crowd that shows up or the crowd that takes part?
I think a lot of it. I mean, esports is kind of a very kind of idiosyncratic example. But I think it's happening a lot, even with users of or communities around other digital media more and more, is that, you know, for instance, you go to study the privacy laws of Facebook. When by the time your paper comes out, like the privacy laws of Facebook have been completely overhauled. So, for instance, I looked at, you know, what doesn't seem long ago in academic terms, 3 years ago, I did my dissertation on a Halo 3 community in Canada. And now the community no longer exists. Halo 3 is no longer played, and MLG is no longer in Canada. It's like, so now all of a sudden my, you know, contemporary cutting edge look at gaming culture, you know, in a specific area at a specific time.
Has become ridiculously obsolete, unfortunately.
Become a historical, you know, historical document or historical look. So it's kind of, you know, it's frustrating, but it's also exciting. And I think one of the things that's so interesting about esports is that it's still trying to find its niche or its audience, really. I mean, you know, I remember the first MLG I went to was 2008 in Toronto. I think the first and last time they had a Toronto Open. Maybe not the last time, actually.
That means anybody can just show up.
Yeah.
Open.
It means it was very spectator-driven, but it was part of their series of live tournaments that they're holding throughout the year, as opposed to just the online tournaments that are kind of their bread and butter now. And there, the audience was whomever was physically present. So it was this very kind of, you know, we're all in this together. All 800 of us in this auditorium right now we're MLG, and you know we're small, but we're lively, and we're going to make a difference in esports. You contrast that to, you know, 4 years down the road, MLG Rally, there's twice as many people in the physical audience, but the physical audience is just there as eye candy for what is, like, I think a half million subscribers or something, upwards in the hundreds of thousands.
It's all about the watching it online.
Exactly. So what's really happened in the interim is that, you know, esports 2008, or at least MLG 2008, was all about trying to build a brand by trying to tap into ESPN or trying to, you know, tap into the world of professional sports. Whereas MLG 2012, 4 years later, is all about trying to tap into a globalized audience of people that watch StarCraft online.
Do you think, I was going to say, do you think that was heralded by what North Korea is doing and that whole?
Absolutely. I mean, I think.
Or is it South Korea? Is it?
South Korea
is
doing.
I was like,
I don't want to sound that ignorant.
Nukes?
No. I saw that dictator on TV yesterday. Yeah. It was really funny. But anyway, South Korean competitive.
I mean, I think, you know, MLG, what happened directly after I defended my dissertation was, you know, global economic crash. A lot of esports leagues went under, most notably the Championship Gaming Series, or CGS, which was...
That's the one, by the way, that was on DirecTV.
Yes.
That I was talking about, I saw all the females playing fighting games.
Well, they were recruited specifically for television.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
It really seems like that.
Nonetheless, that's where I got that perspective. But you see, you know what I mean, that could, you know, that has shaped my view of esports since then.
Yeah.
So you could see why they do what they do.
So CGS was kind of the best and last gasp of esports attempt to go mainstream through television.
And it bombed.
And it bombed, partly because maybe the product wasn't there yet. Maybe it was a little bit ahead of its time. And partly because of the global economic downturn. And maybe because they completely missed the boat on which media they should be going after, which is streaming webcast. And so then you have MLG kind of, I think, you know, take a couple steps back, reconsider its, you know, scale back its operations, reconsider its MO. I think in 2009, it kind of dropped a bunch of its tournaments. And then it picked up StarCraft, and it picked up League of Legends, and then now it's global and it's huge, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because even year to year, just on how they organize everything, it's changed. Like, I remember last year it was just everyone, you know, was playing what they were playing, and now it's like seasonal. What's getting played when?
Yeah.
Who's winning at what point? Where the different events are taking place, and everything is much more organized in terms of when you're going to see what. And, sort of like seasonal sports.
Yeah. And you know what I've seen, like you're saying. When we went to that one MLG, the first one, there were some kids in the audience. They were probably like 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, and they were pumped.
Right.
They were like, I was just like, you know, so you guys watch this online. I was interviewing them for our article, and they were just like, they were like, I love my esports, man. And it was, I mean, they were like esports junkies.
They're probably like jacked on Mountain Dew.
Right. They were like, it was unbelievable. I was like, oh my God, there are huge esports nuts out there now.
Yeah.
Like that's a genre of person, of fan I'd never seen.
Well, and so I think the historical perspective on it is that all these organizations for the past 10 or 12 years have been trying to, or at least some of the North American ones, have been trying to cultivate that enthusiasm through television broadcasting. But really, if you look at all the trends among kids, it's like they're all doing everything on computers.
And look what happens when you try to bring gaming to TV. Yeah. The only thing that survived at all is game trailers of Jeff Keighley's show, like 11:30 at night on Spike once a week. Yeah. Other than that, I mean, G4 is done as of this month.
Yep,
is it really?
Yeah.
It's like their X-Play and Attack of the Shore airing their last episodes.
I think they're officially changing their names to
GQ.
Oh, they're supposed to be more about fashion than games, which is kind of a really weird switch for me.
they've already fallen off DirecTV. DirecTV and them don't broadcast on DirecTV anymore, so I lost being able to watch it a year and a half ago or so because G4 was demanding too much, supposedly, or else DirecTV was willing to pay too little. Who knows?
Yeah.
But the point is, like, that was a big step because that's a lot of subscribers right there, lot of revenue. So that was, like, one sign of one death knell of, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if that shows how ill-fitting games are for TV, as it shows maybe how much of a dinosaur TV is in some ways, you know? I mean, that's kind of a broader question about, you know, technology and platforms and media, but I think it's an interesting one, you know?
Tim, did you have...
I have a question, actually. You follow people playing Halo a lot, so you were more in sync with the first-person shooter sort of stuff with it.
Yeah.
I find there's a trend in the fighting game community, because I go onto, like, shoryuken.com a lot, which is, like, you know, the place to go to if you want to know the fighting game community sort of stuff with it. And I find a lot of them are rejective of the label cyber athletes and of esports. They don't like that term. They're like, we are not that thing. We're not part of those people.
Yeah.
Do you think, is that something that's in other sort of niche groups with it, or is it just within the fighting game community?
You know, I think I don't know. I don't know, actually. I mean, I'll make another plug for another colleague. Todd Harper did his dissertation on the fighting game community, and his dissertation is online. He did it at, I think, Ohio State University. It's on their website. Mm. So I can't. I'm not a pro on fighting game sports or fighting game esports. But what I will say was really interesting. Again, kind of a change between 2008 when I was doing my dissertation research and 2012 when I went to MLG Rally was I asked a bunch of folks. I did interviews at that one. I asked a bunch of folks, you know, so do you consider yourselves a cyber athlete? And they're like, a what? Like, you know, you had in the 4 years since I'd last done the work, you had, you know, people kind of debating the term in 2008, 2009, and then not knowing what the term was in 2012. And so I think it's kind of... I mean, I think it's just competitive gaming.
Really?
You know, I think there is less of a push now to legitimate it as a sport because that's not where their legitimation is going to lie. Their legitimation is going to lie in them being a viable media product through streaming webcasts, right? I think there's less at stake in them trying to make it look like or act like or have the revenue of a mainstream spectator-driven professional sport. But I hadn't encountered that kind of resistance to it, to the term esports. I just kind of encountered a kind of a general unacknowledgement or ignorance of it, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, I mean, cyber athlete just sounds so like Tron. I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't. There's some. It's not something you see in regular sports. Because I think, like, you know, extreme sports would be the closest example I can think of. And they all want to be called athletes, I think. You know, I mean? Just like any other, and say my sport is just as athletic and just as mainstream as your, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As yours is. So I don't know. I tend to see that. They don't want to be called, you know, extreme athletes, or maybe they do, because I'm not, I don't know. But
I think it's an interesting thing for games, because one of the things I think that has changed within games within the past 10 years as much is when I was growing up, you know, in the 90s, games were still something that if you were a geek, you did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then when it got to the 2000s, it became much more just everyone played games.
And I think not to mention being a geek became a lot more mainstream.
Exactly.
And so that sort of happens with it. So it seems like it'd be in a lot of times with it, a lot of parts of what is growing now, it's just, it appeals to the normal people. But what still appeals to geeky people still just appeals to them, you know? And I think almost like board games or stuff like that, or a game like League of Legends or World of Warcraft, those are much more, if you're a geek, you do this. But if, you know, that's not got the mainstream appeal a lot of the times with it.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, and maybe one of the things that that you saw being responded to from the fighting game enthusiasts was that they didn't want to be associated with those geeky guys that play World of Warcraft or that play StarCraft, right? I mean, the one of the really interesting things that I think is becoming very crystallized in the esports world, in the competitive gaming world, is this kind of cultural division between platformers and PC-based games, right? And that's got a lot to do not just with genre and who prefers what genre, but it also has a lot to do with, you know, who can afford to have a high-speed gaming rig in their bedroom
and update it regularly every six months.
Yeah, versus,
to be on the cusp.
Exactly. Versus, you know, who can only afford to have a console in their living room that they, you know, share with their brother and sister and uncle.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, yeah, now that we're kind of talking about it and with our last kind of 12 minutes, what is it about? Because MMOs and that sort of culture kind of blew up around the time of World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And even before that with EverQuest and things like that.
Yeah.
But like before, it became the thing that got made fun of a lot and kind of became the pop culture perception of gaming for a lot of people. And what is it, like, in your research of that, what have you found about those people that do that and their communication and, you know, how they interact with the game and the world?
Of Warcraft. to reference the epic South Park episode. you know, I'm glad you brought up that kind of stereotypical view. I mean, I think, you know, having done interviews for my postdoctoral research with over, 600 to 700 people who play MMOs regularly, first of all, I think it's a kind of a convenient but inaccurate shorthand to call someone an MMO gamer, because MMOs have kind of become commonplace for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, you have World of Warcraft players who lived and died by World of Warcraft, but then they're not going to go on and do whatever MMO is hot next. Once World of Warcraft is done, or once they're done with World of Warcraft, they were no longer MMO players. And so you kind of have this kind of fragmentation, as well as a popularization of games and who plays them, I think. And so, I mean, from my research, I saw, you know, that was perhaps the biggest stereotype that people railed against, was that MMO players were this way. You know, the guy with no life on South Park. But I think there was a, you know, what you could really see was that everyone's playing these things. You know, even if they're not telling their friends or their family or their coworkers that they're playing, they're in there.
Yeah. Well, you know? I mean, I specifically stay away from them because, you know, as somebody who wants to be able to comment on games and wants to, you know, consider myself somebody who sort of has a wide range of things that I play, and just because I enjoy playing a variety of things, I know that if I started playing MMOs, if I started playing WoW, that would maybe be all I'd have time for.
Yeah.
Because it's so all-consuming in time. And I think that's where the stereotype you're talking about comes from, is like these, you know, I don't have to, generally speaking, make appointments to play games that I play.
Right.
I mean, unless I'm going to play online with a friend
that's
at
a very
8
good point.
And it's loose. But, you know, raids, they can be 4 or 8 hours long. They you have to get there at a specific time. A whole group has to come together. So for those reasons, I mean, there is a different level of time commitment.
And it's not that you don't have a social life, but that's your social life.
Exactly.
Speaking.
Yeah. Exactly. That's an interesting distinction too.
Yeah.
Because there's this like the show The Guild shows, you know. I mean, that's obviously a cartoonized version of it. Or not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What's interesting to me is that sometimes I think it's almost better to describe, you know, like being in a hardcore guild and an MMO more like it's a job than it is like you're still playing in the games. Because the motivations that you still have is you're like, you're on a strict schedule. You have to do these assigned roles. You can't break from these sort of things. It's all about a structure.
I'm the medic. I'm support.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm the tank.
You
That's
know,
my job.
That is my job here. It is no longer like, oh, I'm doing this for fun, as much as like, we got to do this because we got to beat that dragon and we got to get those items. So
it's only
going to
happen once every month, this particular raid.
Yeah. Yeah.
This
and
instance.
I think you raise a really good point. I think we're long past the point where any meaningful distinction between work and gaming, or between, you know, with esports, with MMOs, with indie game development.
Oh, and don't forget gold farming.
Gold farming. Yeah. Literally, it is the way of life, or, you know, the lifeblood for many people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting just because there are a lot of just different ways you can approach stuff like that, which does give them a certain appeal. I remember just a few weeks ago on IGN, there was like a chronicle of one guy who created a new character and was going to get, I think, 100 gold by just doing auction house stuff. And it was like his entire chronicle of that. And there's just so many different ways people go into those games. And then Alternatively, it seems like the perception of those people has changed, because I remember like a month or two ago, there was someone running for state senate or congresswoman.
Yeah.
And, you know, she got called out because she played World of Warcraft. And, you know, there wasn't this big ridiculous reaction to it. I mean, it was kind of ridiculous that they smeared her with it, because even her opponent was like, what's it really matter that she plays a game?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think, you know, there's still people who are going to react that certain way, but I think it might be moving more towards the where people kind of accept it to a certain degree.
Well, and I think it's interesting. I mean, this kind of goes into broader, the kind of intersection of technologies and cultures, right? I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I think we have to be aware of, you know, four white guys sitting around a room talking about games is that, you know, we can say everyone plays games, but in fact, you know, I just said it 5 minutes ago, but in fact, not everyone plays games. Mm-hmm. And being kind of a participant in geek culture, you know, yeah, it has gotten popularized, but a lot of people still can't, right? Like in the esport, in the competitive fighting game community, maybe one of the things they're rebelling against is the notion that they're like, again, like those guys that play.
Yeah. And a lot of things with the, I think the competitive fighting game community, there's a big sense of difference in identity between other gamers for them as well. Because a lot of them formed around inner city arcades.
Yep.
And so it was about getting away from someplace that is legitimately dangerous to have a safe place where you'd be hanging with your friends. But a lot of the associations you still have with street culture, sort of, you know, smack talking and being
taunting,
sort of taunting and being a little more aggressive than I think most gamers are normally used to are commonplace there. Mm-hmm. And so it has to, it's sort of an emergence of that sort of thing entirely.
Yep.
So I think there's a distinct difference in between how they perceive themselves and other stuff with it.
Absolutely. And it, for a lot of those folks, it's not safe to be regarded as a geek.
Yeah.
There's one thing I really wanted to ask, following up on what you were talking about, Jordan, and that is about, you said a big part of your research was offline versus online persona.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little about that and some of the things you learned?
Well, I mean, I think you really have to pluralize it. I think it's offline personas versus online personas. I mean, I think one of the things that we encountered in doing this research on MMOs, and this was one of the first large-scale projects, if not the first large-scale project involving, you know, 1,000-plus people that actually met people face-to-face. And so we were not able to categorize them by what game they played. Hmm. We had to categorize them based on, you know, where we met them, whether it was in the labs or in schools or at public gaming events. And so what you really realize is that, you know, everyone, every one of us has multiple offline personas, right? We're a student, we're a father, we're a husband, or, you know, stuff like that. And so I think, you know, this, first of all, we have to get rid of this notion that you have, you become someone else only when you go online. Right? Or that maybe it's...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Definitely true. I mean, even when you're around different groups of friends, whether you're a poser or not, you still, you know, one time you might be the center of attention with this crowd.
Yeah.
And this crowd might be a more boisterous one where you're sort of in the background.
I will never swear around my in-laws, but, you know, swearing might be part of who I am in my day-to-day life with other people, right? So that's the kind of, that's the assumption they have to start with, that there's not my singular offline identity. Similarly, there's not my singular online identity, because not only can I have multiple characters in World of Warcraft and be or play as or play with different things when I do that, but I also become a different player, whether I'm, you know, whether I'm playing as a healer or as a tank or whatever, but B, when I'm playing World of Warcraft versus when I'm playing EVE Online, right? These games literally construct different ways of playing, and therefore we have to accept that they construct different players, right? You become someone else through prolonged play of EVE Online than if you'd spent the same amount of time playing World of Warcraft.
And it probably affects your offline persona as well.
Absolutely. These things, you know, you don't leave yourself, you don't leave your body at the door when you go to check into World of Warcraft, right? I think another thing that I'm trying to do in my research is pay attention to the body when we play, right? So that means everything from, you know, asking who's doing the work of making dinner or cleaning the house when you're spending 5 hours playing Guild Wars 2. When I'm playing five hours playing Guild Wars 2. Similarly, you know, what is my body doing when I'm playing games for that long? I mean, I think we really have to get over this distinction between offline and online. We have to kind of look at it as an interconnected set of relationships. That's kind of where my research is hopefully headed towards.
How about connection-wise, like between offline and online? Did you find parallels? Or did you find that people specifically wanted to be very different from who they are in real life?
You know, I kind of...
Real life in quotes.
me and my a colleague of mine have a kind of pet theory, and that's that it all depends on experience level for one thing. Experience will completely, you know, the more you play a game, the more different you become, right? So I might make my first avatar as something or someone that looks a lot like myself in real life, because I'm experimenting with, you know, self-representation. But then I get over that and I think that's really boring. Why would I want to be or play as this thing when I got to deal with it every single day? Right. So then your second avatar is like completely not you, the opposite of you. And then you get over it. And then you're like, these things are just tools, right? These things aren't me online. These things are just different ways of getting different stuff done. So then, you know, you might have your tank that looks like this because you really wanted, you know, you know, like a gnome tank, female tank, because you really wanted to be subversive with her or something. And then you might have your healer who looks completely like conventional, like a, you know, female blood elf that you think, oh, she's a healer, so she's got to look like that. There's no single one story that you can say, this is how people relate to their avatars. One of the things we did find interesting is that one of the kind of very unnoticed ways that people create an identity for themselves online isn't through their choice of a single avatar, but through how they name their multiple avatars, right? People kind of, you know, when games, when EVE Online is so different from World of Warcraft, so different from Club Penguin, one of the things that unites a person's experience over all these games, maybe not Club Penguin, is their naming protocol, right? So I'm going to name all my characters after a vegetable, or I'm going to name all my characters starting with Doctor whatever. And that's one way that players don't so much craft a identity for themselves with a singular avatar, but craft an identity for themselves with multiple avatars.
That's really interesting.
I mean, I'll put it to you guys. Do you guys have a naming protocol for when you play RPGs? Are you?
Yeah, I try to usually use my own name, but
really,
yeah. But another thing, my other but my other protocol is that I'll pick a female character usually. Because if I'm going to be, as a straight man, if I'm going to be watching her for 50 hours, I'd rather see her than like a dude, personally.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, well, and plus it's very different.
Sure. And my naming protocol in general is I have like the same character name I've used across my PlayStation account, my Xbox account, on my handhelds. When I play with, like, when you name profiles for your save, I always use Ego.
Right.
It's just something, I don't know.
I'm sort of the same way. I used to play MUDs. And so I had a name in a mud, and no one ever used it, so I just used that for everything.
Right, and so...
How about you?
Gosh, it's actually all over the place. I used to name them after animals, now I name them after food. It's kind of... I actually try to be completely random, because I'm aware of this stuff too much.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone to tell who I am. But I think that's really interesting. I mean, you know, you now have these handles. It's not just your avatar name, or it's not just your online persona. It's just part of who you are, right? Yeah. You're now Indigo across a bunch of different shit. Sorry.
That's really cool. Do you guys have anything else you wanted to?
No, I think ask? We got a good range of topics.
Yeah, I think we really did. Well, Nick, I really wanted to thank you for coming in.
Yeah.
I also wanted to say to the listeners that we will have a list of links, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
To all of, you know, your colleagues' work, to some sites people can go to find out some of these more, you know, some of these deeper investigations into gaming, MMOs, and
absolutely.
Yep. Awesome. All right. Well, on that note, I'm Rich Lepore.
Jordan Alseca.
Tim McNeil.
And Nick Taylor.
And we will see you next time. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you.